our attorney says. Don't lie, he's an attorney. He follows the creed. You better too.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I would now like to call the Sussex County Board of Adjustment meeting to order. Our first order of business for this evening will be the approval of the agenda.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion by Mr. Mills and a second by Mr. Hudson that we approve this evening's agenda. All those in favor of the motion, give the usual voting sign.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, motion carried. Mr. Link.
I'd like to introduce Barry Willoughby, attorney, going to give us a presentation on variances, special use exceptions, and fair housing.
Well, Happy New Year.
Good evening, sir.
Good to be here again. I've got good news and bad news. Which do you want first, the bad or the good?
I'll give you
the good news. Stephanie Hansen's daughter had a daughter last night, so Stephanie's a grandmother. Oh. Stephanie was there until 3:30 in the morning and was the primary support person. The father was on active duty, so he couldn't be there. So Stephanie was up for 48 hours straight and is not going to be making it down late. So that's the good news. The bad news is it's only me. So,
that's not that bad, sir.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about fair housing. I spoke with Jamie earlier today. I'm not really a land use expert. You know, I do employment law, employment discrimination, and housing discrimination. So I'm very familiar with the housing, you know, fair housing aspects of this. The technical land use things are really a little bit above my pay grade, as they say. So some of those slides I may punt on when we come to that. And I think Jamie said that we may have another workshop coming up in March.
Yeah. We've got one scheduled countywide in March, don't we?
Actually, Todd told me today it's in February.
February 28th. Okay.
Yeah. February 28th.
Yeah, and my thought was if there were things that Barry, you know, feels Stephanie would be better able to cover at that one, then some of those items hopefully could be addressed then. But I'm pretty confident Barry will cover a lot of things that will be helpful to the board this evening.
If he figures out how to use this advanced clicker thing, so.
Do you know what time on the 28th?
Been on probably all day like the last one.
Yeah. Anybody know how the clicker works on this? Let's see if I can get it going here. That's a nice circle.
And again, that would be for the council, the commission, the board, and the staff.
Like we were the last time, that all day meeting?
Like
but
it was.
This time
no,
I
it's not to be all day.
It's only going to be 2 to 3 hours max.
Oh, okay.
It's like a refresher course.
Oh, okay.
All right, it's on. Or Friday.
Maybe we can get on.
That's when both going to buy, I think.
Hey, you can buy that day, bud.
Oh, yeah.
Happy
thanks.
Menu. That's
right,
bud. Thanks. Yeah, he can buy lunch that day. We will go to lunch with you.
That's perfect.
I'm going to make a note of that right now. Bud's buying lunch on the 28th.
Are you trying to get a laser on?
Oh, brother.
I'll just leave you out.
Yeah, that'll be easier for me. Okay. It's less complicated for me.
28th, we're in lunch with Bud.
Oh, we probably just need to point it on the computer.
Yeah. What's that?
Point it to the computer.
I tried that, but it didn't work. I can do it that way. All right, we're going to talk about the fair housing issues that you guys frequently have to deal with. The fair housing law, you know, obviously deals with housing and not other kinds of discrimination, but it's very similar to things like employment discrimination and issues you see with public accommodations like a public restaurant, things like that. So all the principles are pretty similar, and they're really covering a couple of different points. One is there are protected classes under all of these laws. So if the class is not identified in the statute, and usually it's things like race, sex, religion, national origin, things like that. If it's not protected, if it's not listed as a protected class, then it's not covered. So, for example, lawyers would not be covered in a protected class if somebody decided to pass a law saying, you know, we don't want to have, you know, lawyers subject to certain kinds of things. As long as that wasn't some other kind of discrimination, you know, it could well be. If you're not in that category, you're just plain, in the statute, you're just plain not covered. So as we go through this, you're going to find that there's some differences really in state and federal law. But the point is, it has to be a category that is identified in that statute. One of the requirements is, under the fair housing laws, that you have to make reasonable accommodations to allow a person in a protected category to make use of a dwelling, in this case, a housing situation. So an example that might come to mind is, it's not necessarily housing per se, but it could be housing. So it could be in a restaurant, for example, having a no animal rule, say, in a restaurant that says you can't bring any kind of an animal into the building. Well, that's okay normally, but if you're a blind person, that would stop you from, you know, enjoying the use of the restaurant. So that could be an accommodation that you would have to make if you were a restauranter. Same thing in terms of the housing situation. If you had a housing complex that said no, you know, pets of any kind, no animals in the building, that would be okay in and of itself, but if it had an impact on a protected category, in this case, people who are blind or have a disability, then that could be something you would have to make a reasonable accommodation, you know, for that person so they could enjoy the use of the premises. So that's the kind of things we're going to be talking about. So the housing statute applies to what's called a dwelling under the statute, and that's defined as any building, structure, portion of a structure that's occupied or intended to be used by a residence by one or more families. So there's a whole range of things that are covered by this: homeless shelters for battered women and families, group homes, mobile homes, bungalows, any different kind of facility where a person might live. That would include something like a nursing home. There are some cases dealing with some restrictions in some locations of the country where they're trying, not this county, but around the country, where they try to restrict those kinds of facilities. And they're certainly considered to be dwellings. So again, pretty much anything that you can think of that a person can live in, probably going to be considered a dwelling under the statute. It's going to be something that's going to be covered by the Fair Housing Law, and all these protected categories and non-discrimination clauses will apply to that.
Someone's domicile,
where they live, basically. Yep, that's a good way to sum it. And I forgot to say, please ask questions as we go along, because nothing really bores me more than having me drone on, you know, and not just speak. So if you have questions, please ask. All right, so the next thing is, you'll see, as I mentioned before, there are differences under the federal law and the state law. And in some ways, the state law is actually broader. The Federal Fair Housing Act covers race, color, national origin, religion, sex, and sex means gender, being man or woman, not sex as sexual activity, familiar status, handicap, or disability. So those are the ones that are covered by the federal law. And so you'll see some of these cases, there could be a violation under state law that there is not under federal, because the different kinds of categories are in play here. Under the state law, it's all of everything on the left-hand side, plus creed, marital status, age, sexual orientation, and gender identity. So those are particular categories that apply in Delaware law that do not apply in the federal law. So we actually have a much broader fair housing statute than the federal law provides for, really probably broader than many states in the country.
Hey, under family status, the county has a definition of a family, which is, how should I say, is probably something that's outdated, but I guess, to my mind, we define a family by number of relatives,
The basic definition is any number of parties living together by blood or marriage, or four people that are unrelated.
Right.
And that's, most of the towns have the same.
They have the same.
Hard to enforce.
Well, the technical definition is one or more persons 18 years or older living with a parent or guardian or a designee with written permission, or any person who is pregnant or in the process of securing legal custody of someone else who is 18 years old, under 18 years old, I should say. So the federal law probably is a little bit different than the county definition. And again, if we got into a conflict there, we'd have to really look at it, because it could well be that we'd have to yield to the federal law. Most of these things, it's not necessarily the case you have to yield to the federal law, but it would depend on whether there's an impact on a protected person, the way the ordinance is being applied. So if there is a discrepancy you know, in those definitions, then we would have to.
Should we amend our regulation to conform to the federal law?
Again, I think I would probably defer that one to Stephanie, but I think that, I don't know that you necessarily have to, I think, but you would have to look at, in practice, is it having some kind of a disparate impact on people? If it did, you would have to just do a variance or make some kind of accommodation for that person. It could well be, I know that Stephanie's looking at some mobile home regulations and things like that. So it might be that something you might want to look at the same time when you do it.
And that regulation's been the same since 71.
Yeah. So it may well be outdated. I mean, those things do change.
And, being an inspector is pretty hard hard to enforce.
Yeah. And that's the other side is enforcement may not, maybe very difficult to determine whether you really actually have a violation or not. But
right.
I guess the point is, I think that if there is a conflict, you're going to have to interpret yours so that it doesn't, create an impact on somebody who was in a protected category. And it may be if it's been around since 1971. And not been changed, that really some of the federal definitions have maybe,
Other difficulty that we have is you're dealing with handicapped disability. You have to verify what the handicapped disability is. If
right.
it's a house set aside for the disabilities, then you have to be able to, they're basically exempt from the provision of the definition, except for the number. The number's still an issue.
Right. Yeah, again, and we'll talk about disability in as a special group in a minute or two. But again, if somebody needs an accommodation to have a ramp or something like that, I mean, you're pretty much going to have to grant a variance to allow that. Now, the question you're pointing to, I think, is, do they have to prove that they're disabled to get the benefit of that, variance or accommodation?
More the group home issue.
Okay.
But under disabilities, that's
a building.
Yeah, okay.
Problem with that. Not that we've had a problem with it, we just have to make sure it's bona fide disability.
Right.
That group that's there.
Right, and that's one of the questions is, you've got privacy rights, and then you've got, the obligation under the statute to accommodate them. How do they come together? And basically, a person who wants an accommodation has got the burden of establishing that they're entitled to it. So you're entitled, within reason, to establish that there's a bona fide disability that requires the variance or the accommodation. You can't come in and say, I need an accommodation because I'm disabled, but I'm not telling you, I'm not going to prove to you that I really am disabled. Yeah.
In a previous meeting like this, it was suggested to us, and it kind of, was pretty out there, if you will.
Yeah.
An example was given that, if an individual had a pit bull and he wanted to rent a house, and he contracted to rent the house and brought the pit bull in, that he could be considered a disability if he said that he had some anxiety issues and the pit bull calmed him and he wouldn't need a doctor's verification on that, but simply, just his word or a wife saying, he is much more calm. And the reason I bring that up is not, because we're not renting to anyone.
Right.
But for example, I could imagine that same scenario where someone came before us for a kennel, because in this county you have, after so many animals, you have to, request a variance for a kennel, special use exception, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
In which case, if they were to say that, if they would claim, the disability, and I guess in any of these, whether it be a handicap ramp in a setback or whatever, I'd like to know, and I think the other members would like to know, is A, do we have to just automatically give that to them if they prove to us that they're disabled? We have to allow that, and B, what would be the point in them even coming before us?
Well, there's two things. I mean, you're talking about the difference between a service animal, which is the seeing eye dog. That's a service animal. The person needs that animal to get around. And the other kind is called a comfort animal. Mm-hmm. So, and there are cases, and it has been pretty well established under the Fair Housing Law, that a person who needs an animal, could be a cat, could be a dog, could be whatever, for comfort, because of those kinds of things. That can be a protected kind of activity. I think they have to establish that, though. I think they just can't come in and assert to you, I want the animal, for my anxiety or whatever. There's got to be some kind of verification for that. So I think that is very much similar to, but not quite as strong as the seeing eye dog, because that's a much more clear kind of example.
Right.
Now the kennel thing, the kennel to me, that's a whole different thing, because that's a person who wants to have a private use to keep animals, and you know, so if you're saying they're doing that, you know, as a like a boarding place for animals, or
no,
you know,
their own personal animals, that doesn't matter what you whether you do it for hire or not.
Well, then the question is, do you need to have, you know, five dogs and six cats?
Right.
You know, so I think that would be an awful stretch.
We had that, yeah.
I think that would be an awful stretch for somebody to prove that. And I don't think they'd be able to establish that that is in fact necessary, you know, as a comfort animal. So if they came in and said, well, you know, I need a special permission, you know, from the landlord to have my dog or whatever it is, because I've got anxiety and it you know, calms me down, that kind of thing. That is legitimate. I mean, that's under law, you know, permitted under the law. But to come in and say, I'm going to have an entire kennel here to have 5, 10, 20 animals, whatever it is,
you know
that's not going to, they would have an awful big hurdle to jump to prove that's really,
Somebody was saying moving from another state.
Right.
They had say, seven dogs, and in the county, if you have, was it five?
Five.
If you have more than five, then you have to have a special use exception for a kennel.
Mm-hmm.
So, say I move in from Arizona and I buy a house here, and you know, now the county says I've got to have a special use exception, and I consider those dogs my children, and that, you know, I have anxiety. I mean, you know, I can see where it can go to that, and so at what point you're saying that they would have to show us that they reasonably need that.
The burden is on the person seeking the accommodation.
Okay.
To establish that they need it. Now, you don't want to make unreasonable barriers and be difficult, you know, about that. But what you're giving as an example, you know, needing seven animals, I think that'd be an awful tough stretch for them to prove that under this comfort animal exception that they need to have seven compared to five. I think that would be, you know, almost impossible to prove, I think.
Until we tell them no and they go to the Superior Court and Supreme Court and our decision gets overturned and there we are.
Well, you know what?
I've had these for 10 years and if you take these two away from me or three of them, then you're going to throw me into a panic attack throw me into depression. What do we do then?
I'm not going to tell you that there's never, you know, never say never, you know, that could never happen. but I'm just saying I think that's a stretch, and that would take a lot of, you know, a lot of proof on their part to prove that.
I think any medical doctor would turn around and say the same thing you would.
Yeah.
He'd turn around and say, you know, I don't mind one dog because you're having heebie-jeebies, but seven?
Yeah.
You know,
the big thing is in the statute is reasonable accommodation.
Right.
So I think those are the kind of the magic words.
That's
there.
That's the magic word. Right.
That when those things come up, just – you have to consider it. Is it a reasonable accommodation? Is
gotcha.
Right. seven dogs reasonable? You know.
Yeah. Maybe. And it depends on what your interest in the county. Obviously, having some control on the number of pets, you know, on a property, that's a very legitimate thing. You know, so you've got an interest in that. It's not like you're doing that arbitrarily for some reason. So again, the burden is on them to prove that, and you don't want to be overly sticklers to try. Not in that example, but in other cases. To put people through too much proof that they need a comfort animal, for example, but if it's something pretty far out like that, where they're saying I need seven rather than five, I mean, the burden is on them, and they're going to have some basis to say that.
One thing, I guess, while we're on the discussion of disability, I don't know if the county has an ordinance, but it might be worth suggesting that if a person is handicapped, needs a ramp, and they need that ramp in the setback. Rather than come before this board for us to see somebody come up in a wheelchair and say, yep, you're handicapped, you know, there might be something that the county would want to write as a temporary use or something.
We just added I don't have an ordinance, but we just added some section into the code on the manufactured home parks related to encroachment into the normal setback to allow for ramps and landings and that purpose. And for temporary hardship situations where, say, somebody broke a leg and had to have a wheelchair, then they would be allowed to have a ramp temporarily there for that purpose.
Yeah, I think it would make sense. It would just, you know, be easier administratively for everybody
Is the word comfort or is the word companion?
Companion, same word.
I've
companion animal. I've usually always heard it be comfort animal.
Look out front, there might be a sign that says no animals allowed unless service animals or companion.
Okay.
Because some people, you know, you don't want to leave your chihuahua in the car while you're doing your county business.
Right.
So you bring your chihuahua
in your
under
pocket.
Your arm.
In your pocket, yeah. Chihuahua. Companion's the same thing.
Leave the chihuahua home.
Right.
it's we have it once in a great while. Somebody comes in with a pet.
Companion is the same thing.
I think it's just it's starting to look like just some, you know, use your head, use some common sense.
Oh, yeah.
Applying your ordinances and applying
right.
your laws.
Yeah, again, I think Jamie pointed out, you know, the word's reasonable. You know,
yeah,
so
reasonable.
You try to be reasonable, try to work it out with people. If somebody's trying to take advantage and saying, I need seven dogs, to me, that's not reasonable, and they're you know, and they're taking advantage. Now, can I say never? I mean, never is a big word, but I think it would be an awful stretch for them to do that.
For us, sometimes the word reasonable becomes similar to the word significant.
Right.
So, or significantly.
Well, you know, the problem with all these things, and, you know, in sort of straying outside fair housing, but in all of these kinds of, you know, applying the disability and other kinds of statutes where you say accommodation, reasonable is kind of in the eye of the beholder. So, like, if you look at the Family Medical Leave Act, it says 12 weeks, okay? Well, then everybody knows what 12 weeks is. But then you go to the Americans with Disabilities Act, it's the same thing. It's reasonable accommodation. Well, what is reasonable? And it really depends. I mean, if you're a huge employer, for example, what is reasonable for you to do is a lot more than a mom-and-pop shop because you've got more resources. So the problem is in the application of that, you know, you're always, you know, it's in the eye of the beholder. You're always subject to being second-guessed by a court or somebody else as to what is or is not reasonable. So I think all you can do is just, again, just use your best judgment, you know, and within the resources the county has and, you know, and try to be fair. You know, that's all you can do, you know. Did somebody have a question? I thought there was, you know.
That's not to do with really the county, but, I mean, you're talking about that. Is say you rent your place out and no dogs allowed, and then what you just said, he needs this dog to be and to take care of him, keep him calm and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But you got no dogs allowed. There's a big hassle getting somebody out like that?
Well, again, if you're...
Because you're in the...
If you're, say you own a place at the beach or a landlord of some kind, yeah. I mean, again, that I think that would not be, that could be a violation. Now, how do you...
But the doctor said he needs that.
Right.
Is it a lawyer thing then, going back and forth?
Yeah, and if you're the owner in that circumstance, I mean, are you really, is it really worth it? I mean, it depends on how long the lease is, I guess, and the circumstances and everything
right.
else. So you have to really make some judgments there. But, yeah, so, I mean, there's one thing as to what the black and white law is, and another thing is what's the practicality of actually enforcing it. But I think a landlord in that situation, you know, service animal is very easy, you know, and a comfort companion animal, I think, is given the same status. I mean, I had a case for the Wilmington Housing Authority where we fought about Coco the dog for several years, and finally it was decided that this was way back, you know, under these statutes, it was finally decided that Coco was a companion or a comfort animal and had the same rights as a service animal. So, you know, that I think has now gotten to that level. It wasn't clear for a long time if there were distinctions to be made there or not. So.
Protected class of gender identity, what's that, Italian?
No, that would be national origin.
Okay.
As you know, Italian, you know, German, Irish, whatever. You
All
know.
Right, that's what I'm
that
saying.
Would, but gender identity, there's a whole thing, the LBG community.
If a man thinks he's
right.
a woman, but.
Right. Right,
okay.
or is changing his, you know, his or her identity one way or the other that applies. It would also apply if there were, and again, in your context, I don't think it's going to come up that much. It comes up more in the employment context. But let's say you had a man who presented himself as a woman and it didn't actually go ahead and change his gender. I mean, or, you know, to female, he would still have gender identity protection. And same thing, you know, for a woman who presented as a man. And it even goes to things like, you know, the idea if you had, again, not very likely in the housing context, but let's say you had, in the employment context, you had someone say the man was too effeminate, you know, that would be protected, you know, as a kind of discrimination. A woman being too masculine, that would be gender bias. In the housing sector, you know, I don't really quite see how that would come up. I guess it could, you know, but I don't see an easy example.
I've heard
of
that.
Yeah. But that's what that is. That's what that relates to.
Thank you.
Yep. All right. We're going to go through some of the categories. All right. So these are just the different kinds of. I think I skipped one over one past one slide here. But, you know, obviously race would be, you know, African American, Caucasian, Asian, things like that. Color, you know, is a person's skin complexion. National origin would be, you know, background Hispanic, Native American, you know, whatever their country of origin is. So those would be the kinds of things that would be covered by those categories. Oh, I think I'm not pushing enough. That's what it is. We've got this set up so they float up one at a time instead of all coming up at one time. So she did a nice job with this. So national origin discrimination really would relate to whether or not you're willing to deal with people of certain, you know, background from other countries, things like that. Again, I don't know that that would come up too much. You could certainly have issues come up with claims of discrimination based on being, say, an Hispanic background, things like that. If that were to be proven, you know, those kinds of issues are certainly going to be covered by the fair housing laws and would be illegal under the fair housing laws. Okay. Religion, obviously, there's obvious, you know, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, whatever. Creed is a belief system, so it doesn't necessarily have to be a religious principle per se. There is a case out there, again, not in the employment context, that sort of illustrates how this goes. There was an employer who was, you know, requiring flu shots, which a lot of employers do, had an employee who objected to the flu shot based on his vegan status. And I guess the flu shot has like some kind of poultry or something in it, I think. So this person was, you know, genuinely believed no killing of animals for food and things like that, objected to taking the flu shot on that basis. And the court said, you know, although that's not a religion per se, that's a genuine belief, that's a creed. And the person could not be forced to do that. You'd have to make some kind of a reasonable accommodation if you could. Now, again, it's a balancing act. Let's say in that circumstance that the person is in an environment where they're dealing with people who could be subject to getting the flu, and it's really not safe for them to be, say, in a nursing home or a children's situation, things like that. It's a balancing act. Can you find some other way to accommodate them to make sure that the residents are protected without requiring them to take the flu shot? So you've got to consider any number of things, like transferring them to a different job, mask, things like that. So that's the idea behind a reasonable accommodation. If there's a genuine belief like that, if there's a way to meet that need without having to have the person, in this case, take the flu shot, that's something you've got to consider. And it's, again, a balancing of what is reasonable under the circumstances. And there's a point where it becomes an undue hardship on the county, in this case, in the housing context, to make the accommodation.
So that's what that fight in court's about, creed, where the mother and father don't want to have medical treatment because of their beliefs. Is that,
I think, the case you're talking about was pretty horrible. I think, I'm not sure if it was in New Jersey or not, but I think it was the second or third child this family had passed away because they didn't get medical treatment.
Would that fall under this type of...
It could be. That's a creed, or it could be a religion. But it's an example, though, of where, you know, there is a clash here, because they were actually prosecuted, you know, because they, as an adult, they would have the right to say, I'm going to turn down medical treatment, no matter what the consequences are. The courts have said that, you know, notwithstanding that that's their genuine belief, religious belief, you know, for minors, you know, the law overrules that and requires you to get medical treatment, at least until that person's old enough to make it their own decision. So that's, again, you know, none of these things are absolute. You know, that's an example of where you can have a clash like that. And I think they had absolutely, you know, sincere beliefs, but, you know, in that case, you know, minor children didn't have an opportunity to make it their own decision. So the law says, you know, that's something that, you know, notwithstanding your religious rights and your First Amendment rights, you know, we can overrule. So you do have a lot of those kinds of balancing things to deal with. I think we covered a lot of this already on the next slide down, or next part of the slide down, the family status. Lawrence mentioned the county definition. This is the definition out of the Fair Housing Act.
So I'm protected under the marital status?
You are.
Thank you. Yes.
figures.
And a lot of us have gotten old enough to be protected by the age statute, so we're, you know, that's a good
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, bud, yeah. You're more like the age statute.
Better protect yourself.
Oh, God.
No common law in Delaware.
No common law marriage in Delaware, true. Yep.
There's not in Delaware?
Delaware, as I'm not a family lawyer, but as I understand it, there is not common law marriage.
Used to be, right? 7 years?
Pennsylvania is. I don't think Delaware ever recognized it. I don't know. I mean, again, it's not my my area of practice, but I'm pretty sure that that's the case, that we just don't plain don't recognize it. So, all right, so this is an interesting case, this is from Delaware. Newark passed an ordinance, really an attempt to limit student housing because of all the, you know, the problems that kids have. And I think Vice Chancellor Noble actually decided this case, and he said, you know, they passed the ordinance because they were trying to limit college students because they're college students. They're engaging in certain kinds of activities, but basically under the marital status part of our statute, the court found that you really could not do that. You couldn't limit single students out and treat them differently than others under the family status and marital status of sections of our statute. So that's an example where, you know, sometimes an ordinance certainly has a certain common sense principle behind it, but it runs up against these standards, and you're sort of presuming in that case that all students, for example, are going to be misbehaving rather than trying to control certain ones who are. So anytime you get into those kinds of ordinances, I'd say you really want to have your attorney, you know, give you advice about that and make sure that that's really something that can be justified under these statutes. Because it's you know, Vice Chancellor Noble found this to be discriminatory based on the face of it because of the, you know, the impact on students. All right. I think we've covered that. Okay, handicap or disability. Let's talk about that a little bit more because I think that's a major one that we have. The definition of handicap is actually pretty broad. I mean, I think we all have a good concept of what a physical or mental limitation is to be a disability or a handicap. You know, you can't lift more than 50 pounds, or you have some other kind of, you know, limitation on you. But the statute is actually a little bit broader than that. You could also have a situation where a person is being regarded as being disabled, even if they don't have any actual physical, you know, limitations. So what I mean by that, you know, obviously AIDS, HIV has kind of been in the news for the last, I don't know, 20 years or whatever it's been. There's certainly a point where a person can have the illness and have no physical problems whatsoever. And, you know, they're completely fine. You know, they're being treated. They have no physical limitations. But if that person were being treated differently because of their medical condition, even though it's not having any limitations on them, they would be protected under this so-called regarded as definition. So if, you know, in this case, the governing body, you know, regarded a certain kind of person with an illness or a condition as being disabled, even if they're not physically limited, you know, they would have that protection under the law. The other one is, and again, it's difficult to see how this will play out in a housing context, but the other kind of disability is having a record of impairment. So, you know, like if my high school teacher said, you know, that Willoughby guy, he's out there. I mean, you know, that's in my records, and somehow somebody found out about it, that would also be an impairment under the law or a disability under the statute because I have a record of a disability. Now, it's hard to see, again, in your context, how that would be even become known to you. And even today, you know, it's even hard to see how that would come up in the employment context because you've got so many more restrictions on the way records are given out today. But the time the statute was passed, that was put in there so that if there was something even mistakenly put into somebody's record saying they had like a mental disability or something like that, they would be considered disabled under the statute and have all the, you know, all the entitlements. And principally a non-discrimination, you know, entitlement in that case because you can't really accommodate a non-existing disability. So I think that's a kind of an important principle to, you know, keep in mind.
Now, for the mental impairments,
mm-hmm.
How far have you seen that go? Because I'm just curious about things like somebody who maybe has PTSD or something like that, and this board will occasionally see cases come up that typically are for use except special use exceptions that where we're looking at whether there's a substantial adverse effect on neighboring and adjacent properties.
Right.
And I guess one of the things that I'm wondering is if, you know, we have somebody that comes here and has presented evidence that they are suffering from some sort of mental impairment. You know, I presume that's something the board should be taking into consideration.
Well, again, it would be whether you might need a variance. I mean, I'm not sure what you would need for a mental impairment. I mean, obviously, a ramp is a very clear example.
I was thinking of a neighbor.
A neighbor in opposition because they don't want somebody mentally unstable.
Oh, that would be a loser. I mean, the neighbor's opposition to having a person there
wasn't thinking that. I was thinking of, and I think that's a fair one because we have had that come up.
Right.
But I was thinking of one where somebody is presenting a use that they're trying to use, and somebody comes up and is presenting evidence that they have a disability that would be, you know, affected adversely by this proposed use.
Yeah. Okay. So I mean, let's say it's post-traumatic stress syndrome, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And the property has a lot of loud noises or something that make impact the person, things like
rifle
that.
Rifle range or a kennel.
Yeah. I don't know that would be something they could restrict their neighbor from developing their property in that way. I mean, I think that if they needed some kind of accommodation so they could use their property, I think that would be one thing. But to say that I have a disability that might be affected by my neighbor's use of their property. Again, I think it's a stretch because that's, they're not asking for an accommodation themselves. They're trying to block an exist, what presumably is a permitted use under the ordinance. I could see if you got into an argument about whether or not the neighbor wanted a variance, then I think that's one of the factors you'd have to consider, whether it's going to have some impact on the whole community.
The issue we have with the special use exception is the standard is whether it substantially affects adversely
the uses
of neighboring and adjacent properties.
Right.
So that's where
I could see it in that context.
There is I could see some overlap there.
Right.
I could see it in that context where they have a right to object to the use of the neighbor's property.
Somebody that's basically shell shocked that the neighbor wants to put in a rifle range.
Right.
That'd be tough.
If there's a
just going to say that military personnel. Yeah. I'm listening very intently to him about military personnel coming back. It's such a big issue today.
Or somebody that's been attacked by a pack of dogs and they some next door neighbor wants to kill them.
Yeah, I'm not a land use lawyer, but I'm assuming there are certain uses where the person, if they want to say a kennel or a rifle range, that they would have the existing right under the ordinances to do it. They wouldn't need any special permission, from the Board of Adjustment to do that. Does that happen in some cases where they've already got the existing right?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, we do have some people that come, after
right.
the fact.
Yeah. Right, no, but based on the zoning, would there be cases where somebody could just say they don't need any special permission from the board to have a kennel or is that always a special use? Okay. Well, I think I think where the neighbor is given, by statute a right to not be overly affected and have a say in that, I think that's is a really legitimate concern.
That's maybe some area the board needs to tread lightly.
Yeah,
it would be our responsibility to make that determination. Does it substantially affect adversely?
Right. Now, I guess then again, I'm not
without discriminating.
Right. I'm not a land use lawyer, but
John, that's hard. Sometimes that's hard.
Yeah, I'm not a land use lawyer, but I'm assuming there are some things under the zoning code where the person doesn't have to come in and get a special use variance. I mean, it's just permitted under the ordinance. Yeah. Is that right?
If you're in a certain zoning classification, it's a permitted use, then you don't.
Right. So what I'm saying is if it's a permitted use in that area, I think it's difficult for the neighbor to come in and say, that it affects me adversely, so you can't do it. Okay?
Well, but we're not getting those. We're getting the ones where
it's
either not a permitted use or
exceptions. I got you. Right. So if it's already a permitted use, I don't think that the neighbor would have a good argument to come in and say, even though it's a permitted use, it affects me too much because of my condition, assuming totally bona fide. I don't think that would be a winning argument for the neighbor. On the other hand, if the the neighbor is coming in for a special use, and you've got to consider the impact on the surrounding properties, I think that's a legitimate concern. You'd have to, because it is changing, fundamentally changing the character of that person's use of their property, and it's not otherwise permitted. So I think that would certainly be something you'd have to be very concerned about. Okay, but I think they would have to have some kind of a standing, for lack of a better word, some reason or the code why they get to have a say in it.
Sure. Yeah,
but
So we have to keep in mind discrimination not only for an applicant but for the opposition.
Right. In that context, yes. Yeah, I mean, if somebody came in and said that's really going to change the character of my use of the property, I think that's something you've got to consider. Yeah. I mean, where you come out on it, again, it depends on all the facts that are in front of you, but it may well be that's something you say, under these circumstances, we can't do that. Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit about the kinds of claims you face and the different types of claims that are out there. The first one's called disparate treatment, and that's a fancy word for intentional discrimination. You know, that's the old no Irish need apply, you know, back in whenever the day that took place. So actual intentional, you know, discrimination against a person who is in a protected category, you know, an actual intent to do that. I don't think you see many of those today. I don't think people, you know, usually have that outward, you know, intention today, but it is certainly a kind of discrimination that's illegal under the law. The harder part is what's called a disparate impact claim, and what that means is there's an unintended consequence of what is a neutral law, rule, or regulation. So where that came from, again, a lot of these principles are being borrowed from the employment context because they sort of grew up in that environment first. And way back in the 1960s, I think it was, the Supreme Court adopted this theory that said that basically even if there was not an intent to discriminate, if the impact of your rule has a disproportionate impact on a protected category, it can be illegal. So in that example, it was a high school in the South, late 60s, early 70s, a factory that said you have to have a high school diploma to work here. And in that part of the country at that time, that had a disproportionate impact on African Americans because they were graduating high school at much lower rates than whites in that area at that time. Okay, so that was a disproportionate impact of what was appearing to be, you know, a facially neutral kind of rule. Now, that doesn't end the analysis. You know, if the employer could prove that you needed a high school degree to do the job, they would be okay.
Competent.
But they couldn't prove that. But they couldn't prove that it really made any difference in doing that particular job. So that disproportionate impact, even though unintended, you know, is going to be illegal. So another example, let's say that somebody comes up with the idea that you should have a law degree to be a lawyer, okay? Despite any impact on any group, okay? That's not going to be a claim because that's a legitimate, you know, requirement for the job. So in this kind of analysis, again, you've got to look at what's the potential, you know, unintended consequences, impacts of these kinds of rules. And if there is an impact, you know, is it going to have, you know, is it something you really have to have? Is it a legitimate, you know, reason that you can't find some alternative to get around the problem? Okay, and that's the ones that are really, I think, problematic today because you've really, you know, it's hard to foresee all those things, and you know, all you can do is do your best to react to, you know, kinds of issues, you know, raised like that. But I think those are the very, very difficult claims that, you know, you face and other people in your position face. And then the last one is we've talked about a good bit already, and that's the duty to make a reasonable accommodation. So that's really kind of the affirmative obligation you have. These first two are non-discrimination. Basically, don't treat anybody differently, and that's kind of the end of your obligation. The third one is to actually make some kind of an accommodation to allow a person to use their dwelling or some other kind of, you know, change to allow them to have the benefit of their home. That makes sense? Is that, if it doesn't make sense?
Here's one that, and maybe some of you were thinking the same thing I was, that sometimes we'll get cases where there will be someone is looking to construct a dwelling,
right,
or to expand a dwelling into the setbacks.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the case that comes up more frequently is when it's a new construction.
Right.
And they are looking at maybe the folks who are living there are elderly or,
right,
or are planning to have this be the, you know, the retirement home.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to, and I use the word want because that seems to be what we hear a lot,
not need.
That they want to have the house of a certain design, and because of that, they need to go into the setback areas.
Bedroom on the first floor.
First floor bedroom, perhaps an elevator in some circumstances. And we will, you know, we would look at it, and sometimes you look at the square footage of the home, and it's
3,000-4,000.
Yeah, it could be pretty big.
Right.
So, you know, in looking at that, have you seen case law out there on those kind of cases? Because we, you know, that's the kind of case that we do see from time to time, and
right.
And I suspect that we'll see more of that.
It's based on want, not need.
Right. Well, again, I think that the person requesting the accommodation, you know, has the burden of proving the accommodation is needed under the law. You know, so now whether they could establish that if you got into a fight with them to get a, you know, they could get a physician to say they would need it, or they would need it within some reasonable period of time. You know, they're 75, and in the next 5 years they're going to need a ramp, or you know, whatever it is. You know, that could be one thing, but just simply having a desire for it without some accompanying.
I think the ramp issue is been less of an issue than ones where it's an interior design factor, where someone's got the footprint of a house and they want to make it go into the setbacks and typically up,
right,
to give them additional relief. That one has been, I think, a little more. I think it's clearer with a ramp,
right,
than it is with that.
Right.
Need a bigger house to accommodate the larger family and grandkids. And,
yeah, again, I don't
always,
think.
I ask that question like you do. That in some of the minutes, you'll see where I say, is this a need, or
yeah,
do you want this?
Right.
And I normally will throw that, if I have an attorney there, I'll throw that at him. And
we duck, or we.
He has to go to his
right.
client.
Right.
And I think
ask
that's
him.
A big thing that's come up, that it is a need or a want.
I think it has to be a need.
Okay.
I mean, I think there has
right.
to be some basis under one of these protected categories to say that's a need, not a desire.
Yeah, a 40-foot lot.
Because that's why you have these kinds of regulations. You know, if
right.
everybody would want to go into the setback, not everybody,
right.
but some people.
You have a 40-foot
yeah.
lot. How much can you put on a 40-foot
right.
lot? That's a need
right.
to accommodate.
Yeah, right. So, again, I think it has to be a need, and it has to be based on, you know, one of these protected categories. So that if there is a physical need,
mm-hmm.
you know, things like that. Certainly, you know, that's one thing. But just the fact that I desire to make, you know, use more of my land, I mean, like most people probably have that desire. I mean, but that's
I
why you have.
Intended it.
But that's why you have setbacks. You know, that's the
right.
whole idea.
Why
so,
would you have planning and zoning if these
right.
people could go, I said, might as well just everybody
right.
do what they want to do.
So the short answer is I would say that it's got to be based on a need, not just a desire.
And that's
know,
something
and,
the applicant or the,
right.
the person claiming the accommodation needs to prove.
They have the burden of proof. Yeah. I mean, now you once they do that, then you have to decide, okay, is this something that we can – you know, is it going to fundamentally change the character, for example, of the neighborhood, things like that. If it's not, can we reasonably accommodate it? Are there other ways we can get around, you know, the problem? You know, but and to still allow the person to use the, you know, the you know, their property. So you've got to, you can't just say no. You've got to go through and look at all the factors and decide if there's some way you can meet the you know what they want. But they've got to be protected in a protected category. It's not just you know it's got to be like a disability where they. You know, have some basis to request that accommodation. It's just not a general obligation to accommodate anybody. You know, with a desire, it's got to be based on one of these categories.
I don't know how many times my wife asked me that. Is it a need or a want?
Right.
Very. It's important.
Yeah, it may be important, but I mean to people, but it doesn't. You know, under the law, you're not going to be. Required to accommodate that, you know,
right.
unless it's a need based on one of these protected categories. Because I mean, that's why you have zoning. That's why you have these kinds of things. And the law is very clear. You know, it's not these fair housing things are not designed to override all zoning ordinances and things like that. They're designed to try to let people who have
from
certain kinds of
I
restrictions.
From everything I see, you know, just going
yeah.
over all this
right.
as you're going over it, from what I see, it's the questions you ask that are important. That seem to be coming up. They're important. There is the rules, but it seems like we should be asking the questions, like you said, that are important that
right.
will give you this.
I think it's a good point. You know, again, some of this translates from the employment practice area, you know, less so than housing, but I think it's a good practice for you to adopt. In the employment area, if a person comes in and says, I have a disability and I need an accommodation, the EOC says you've got to do what's called an interactive process, have a discussion, essentially, and find out what it is that you can do, if anything, to accommodate that person. And it doesn't have to be the absolute best accommodation. It doesn't have to be, you know, what they want necessarily. It just has to be reasonable and has to get the job done. I mean, the standard for that, for reasonableness, is getting the job done. So in your context, when somebody's coming before you, I think it's a really good point. I mean, you want to have a conversation with them in an open and honest way and find out, well, really, what is it their concern? And is it based on a protected category? You know, is it a need or a want? And then, you know, are there, if it's a problem for you because it's, you know, invading a setback or it's causing some problem with the neighbors, whatever, are there other ways, you know, that we can reach an accommodation that will allow them to use their property, but may not necessarily be what they have asked for? So I think that communication, really, that's the ultimate key, I think, to all these things. I mean, just, you know, and I think, truthfully, I know nobody wants to, you know, have the courts, you know, review things like that, but I think the judges are really cognizant of the fact that if the public body's really tried hard, been reasonable, tried to, you know, to be fair, that weighs, I think, on a judge. I mean, I think that they know that there are going to be times when people come in and try to take advantage. If you're trying to do your best to be reasonable and fair, I think that has a psychological impact, I think, on a judge looking at one of these cases. All right, let's see. I just put that up because I thought that's where the question was going. Okay, this is something that really is more, I think, more in Stephanie's area, but she, you know, I think it's kind of covered some of the things that you've been talking about. Maybe she can hit on a little bit more, but just the whole, you know, situation where an applicant requests a variance and how the process works. So I think we had mentioned this before in response to one of the questions, but I think just kind of repeating it, the initial burden is on the applicant, you know, to come forward and say, I need this kind of accommodation. At that point, then, you know, you have to respond to that. You know, find out, you know, what the concern is, react to that, and, you know, if you can accommodate it, yeah, you have an obligation to do that. But if you can't accommodate it, then, you know, you're not in violation of the law just because they made that initial burden, that initial showing that there is some kind of a disability or some other kind of situation that, you know, that might require a handicap, or excuse me, an accommodation.
Barry, just yeah. The slide before that.
I can go back, I will, let me see.
Yeah, he's just got it going forward.
That's the best I can do.
The last part of it, it says burden on municipality to approve requested accommodation is unreasonable. Could you hit on that a little bit for us? Because I guess I'd kind of like to have a better feel for when that burden would shift, or when that type of context would potentially come up.
Well, I mean, you know, if a person comes in and says, I want to, a variance to put, you know, a ramp on my property, you would have to show, you know, say why that's not a reasonable thing to do. Is it affecting the neighbors? Is it doing something else in the community? You know, that's not a fair and reasonable request. And the problem, you know, is that, as we've said before, you know, there's no black and white lines in this statute, like a lot of the other, you know, discrimination statutes, as to what is reasonable and unreasonable as compared to, say, the FMLA, where it's 12 weeks or not. So it's a case-by-case analysis, and you know, the municipality has the burden of proving that the requested accommodation is either not reasonable or is so burdensome that it, you know, fundamentally changes the character of the neighborhood, something like that. So you wouldn't have to do it.
So if someone came and you, I guess we'll go back to, I hate using the same example, but the one where somebody says, I want a house that is into the setback areas and is 4,000 square feet because we've gone up so far,
right?
And you know, I want that because it'll allow me to have better access to the floors and whatnot. And the board, if it were to say, you know, you're kind of creating your own hardship here, you could build one within the confines of the building envelope that might be a 3,000 square foot home or, right. or something, you know, or another large dwelling. I guess the thing that I would wonder is, you know, as the board goes through its analysis, is it going to have to hit on those type of issues as well?
Again, it's a needs and wants thing. I mean, if the person comes forward and says, I have some kind of a disability, and I can't quite come up with a scenario where they would want a 4,000 square foot house.
Where they have a lot of medical equipment or okay. something where they need that extra space.
Okay. Well, so that, yeah, that's a good example. So in that context, you might have to accommodate that. I mean, it's very fact specific. You know, and you might have to find out, you know, what exactly is it they need? Why do they need that extra space? You know, and it very well may be that they have, you know, a reasonable request, you know, in those circumstances.
And I think in a lot of cases, the board does that.
Right.
I mean, there's been, I wouldn't want to count the number, but there's been a fair amount of cases over the past year or two that, you know, someone has come here and has needed a variance because they maybe have you know, become less ambulatory and they need a wheelchair and they need to reconfigure their house and
right.
put an addition and that we've seen those approved. But, you know, I just kind of was curious when that burden would kind of shift and how the board would go about proving it.
Well, they would have to come forward and say, I need a 4,000 square foot house instead of 3,000. And then you would say, well, okay.
Why?
Why? Yeah, establish why that is. And they tell you, and they show that, in fact, that's a reasonable need
right.
that they have because they need that equipment, that kind of stuff.
Life support system,
whatever it is.
Take care of them.
Right. Then you would have the burden of saying, well, either that's unreasonable for something to do with the location, you know, maybe it's has some impact on the other neighbors or the community or, you know, something like that. You would have to establish why that's not a reasonable request or why that request cannot be accommodated. And again, it's very, very fact specific. I mean, I don't know all the situations where that could come up, but I think there could be circumstances where that request really makes such a fundamental change, you know, in the area.
We have a medical hardship
yeah.
Section in our
right.
ordinance.
Right.
That
so
covers a lot of this,
right?
That so, you're saying, and it could probably be improved to cover some of this.
Yeah. Well, again, you have that written. I think you're doing it, you know, as a matter of practice. But I think that, you know, in that example, if they can prove that really is the case, as compared to just wanting to have a bigger house and using that as an excuse, you know, to get it, that's one thing. And that's again, there's the kind of the black letter law, and there's the enforcement of it. It really is going to be difficult for you, I think, sometimes to ferret out whether somebody's really, you know, making use of that as an excuse. But that's, you just do the best you can with that, and you kind of test the bona fides of their position. Do they really need to have that much bigger of a property to have the medical equipment they want?
Would you be able to ask someone, I don't know, legally, you know, could you ask someone, well, could you bring documentation to substantiate your disability?
I think you can. I mean, I think it depends whether it's obvious or not. I mean, if you know, somebody
yeah,
comes in a wheelchair,
yeah, somebody's coming up
that's
a wheelchair,
one thing.
That's obvious.
If you really have, I mean, I wouldn't do it unless you really had
mentally,
had a good.
A lot of it's mentally and.
Yeah, if you had a good faith doubt about it,
yeah.
And I think you've got it. And
certain.
Yeah.
You're uncertain.
And it may not necessarily be a medical doctor. It could be any number of medical providers. You know,
psychiatrists.
I mean, and even some, you know, like. Physician assistants. Sometimes I've seen cases where that, you know, they've said that's enough, you know, even though that's not a, you know, certified doctor.
Again,
or things
that's
like
up
that.
To us to
yeah.
see if that's.
If and I wouldn't do that unless you feel like you know that you really need that. You don't really, you know, you need to, you have some doubt about the, you know, the truth of whether or not
yeah.
they're really really disabled. But again, they have the initial burden of proving that they are within a protected category, and that what you know and what their request is needed because of that category. And disability is obviously a you know, prime example
mm-hmm.
of that. And again, you got to be very careful. You know, you've got privacy concerns and HIPAA concerns, and all that is way outside the scope of what we're talking about. But I think you could establish a process if you really needed to have documentation to, you know, to prove that the person proved that they're in fact, you know, disabled, you know, covered by the law. All right. So these are just different examples that you know really. You know, Stephanie put up about what is and is not reasonable. You know, it really is very case specific. You know, in fact, you know, case by case kind of example. And I don't know that we need to go through, you know, each and every one of these. But you know, it is definitely fact specific, and you know, what is reasonable you know, and not reasonable really just depends on the evidence that you get.
I think we covered that.
Mm-hmm.
Am I going backwards now?
Mm-hmm. I think it's going backwards to me.
You've been there.
Yeah.
It's going backwards now.
Yeah, it's going backwards on me. See if I can get it to go frontwards.
It's got mind of its own there, didn't it?
It does.
Yeah,
look at this.
Done that one.
What did I do to this thing?
I don't know.
Hit the other key.
That's the right one. Keep going.
Keep going and see what it does. Whoop.
Keep going.
All right, we're going way back.
Oh. I think we're going way backwards now.
Yeah, what hit the other direction? Oh, there's Stephanie's mom, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're way back now. Now you're coming forward.
Am I?
Yep.
Yeah, all right.
Coming. Keep coming. There.
There we go.
Yep, there you go.
Yeah, so we've been through, I think, most of these. We've covered the different examples of, you know, disabilities. In the disability area, you know, things like drug abuse, that's not going to be a disability, okay? But a person who is like a recovering alcoholic or recovering, you know, in the drug addict, they're going to be covered. But the law does not cover people who are current users of illegal drugs. So they can't come in and ask for an accommodation because, of course, now we've got the medical marijuana law, so I don't know what to say about that.
Yeah,
but but in general, they can't come in and say, I want an accommodation because I want to smoke, you know, pot on my premises or things like that. I'm not just, yeah. So now you do get into some pretty interesting questions. I mean, I guess with medical marijuana, if they were to have a certification, that would be really new grounds, you know, for us to deal with. They could well be protected. I mean, and, you know, of course, and we've got the whole, you know, we've got federal law that still says it's illegal.
Lawyers going to have a tough time when that stays in, THC stays in your system for 30 days. They're going to have a tough time proving that they're still under the influence on Monday morning.
Well, the other thing is with that, and again, this is in the employment context, but for alcohol, you know, you've got a very black and white standard. It's 0.08, and you're under the influence. Well, what is it for marijuana? I mean, what proves you're actually impaired? Because still, you still wouldn't have the right to come to work or, you know, things if you're impaired, but how do you prove that a certain level of whatever the substance is, makes you impaired. I mean, that's one of the things that, you know, it's not in their statute. Some other states, I think Arizona has some standards they're trying to put in place. But it's really, you know, it's kind of a whole new world, and those kinds of issues start coming up. And in this context, I mean, I guess if you had somebody who had a certification to get medical marijuana, whether you could treat them differently or not, I mean, that would be a real interesting test case, because it's still illegal under federal law, but it's lawful under Delaware state law. So I mean, that one would be one where I think you'd have to really get Jamie.
About non-smoking areas.
Well, again, I mean,
marijuana.
Well, I mean,
I don't think we have that come up, but just.
Well, I was going to make a smart remark and say they could have a brownie instead or something, but I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think
that
that's
could be a reasonable.
No,
that could be the accommodation. You
no
can't
public
smoke,
use.
Right? But I think that's a different issue. I mean, really, I mean, if it's medical, really medically necessary, I'm not sure that you would have a right for public use, you know, at a restaurant or someplace else like that. I mean, that would be a tough call, I think, for people to make.
A changing world, what I'm seeing.
Well, we're talking about some outer limit stuff here. I mean,
yeah.
But it is a very interesting thing as to, you know, you start getting these kinds of, you know, this medical marijuana stuff. I mean, how do you know the person's impaired?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
How do you, you know, you've got.
You know, most drugs leave your system within a 24, 48-hour period, but THC stays in the fatty tissue of your bladder for up to 30 days.
Mm-hmm.
So 30 days later, you're still testing positive.
Right.
That's a tough one.
And that's a problem for employers with drug policies, because you test, and then if the person really has a certification, you know, that they're allowed to have medical marijuana, then, you know, can you discipline that person, you know, in the absence of showing they're under the influence? I would say it'd be tough to do. You know, you'd have to have some kind of a standard. Some states are trying to develop that. I mean, like Arizona is coming up with some kind of a measurement that supposedly indicates where, sort of like the alcohol 0.08 standard. But We don't have it in Delaware, and I don't know, you know, how you deal with that. And then you overlay that with, you know, the fact that it's still illegal under federal law. I mean, you're really in a kind of a major quandary there. But I don't know. A little bit off the subject, but it's
That's a good point, though.
Yeah. That's what we got to look forward to, right?
Yeah, look, come up here and go, I need a variance. Wait a minute, I got to get a brownie.
That's the one I think you, Jamie, you were talking about. Is that the one that I...
Yeah, there at the bottom.
Yeah.
You covered that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you really... It's very fact-specific, and, you know, I think the idea that somebody mentioned of having a dialogue really is the key.
Yeah, I think it's just one the board needs to keep in mind as where we stop.
Yeah, I mean, these are basically, I mean, these are just different examples of all the things that we've been talking about. I don't know that we need to go through all those again. I mean, this is the, you know, the set, the waiver of the setback of 200 feet. In this particular case, the court said you don't have to give a waiver. In this Epler case, you know, court said that because there was no showing of a need to have a variance from this 200-foot setback they had in that area, you know, in the city of Cleveland. So there are all cases where the court says, you know, the applicant just has not proven that, you know, that accommodation is necessary. And the courts have said, you know, that's fine. You're upheld as to you know, what you're doing. All right, so I think we've talked about these, just how the whole process of how you go through proving a, you know, a claim. This is just another example. I mean, any time you have an situation where there's a group home being sought, you know, there's going to be a lot of eyes on you for that if there's a claim that you're trying to prohibit somebody from having a group home that doesn't let people of a certain kind, you know, live there. So there's a number of cases out there, you know, like this one that again, if you can prove that you can't make the accommodation, you know, that's one thing. But the court's going to be very, very closely scrutinizing whether or not that's a pretext, you know, to really stop kind of the NIMBY idea, not to stop something from happening in your backyard.
We had a complaint recently on group homes for parolees, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
What? Parolees that have just gotten out of... For a Sussex Correctional Institute,
right.
For rehab purposes,
right.
Before they go out into the main world, I guess. So we do get some complaints about that. It seems like there's a few houses popping up where they're creating group homes to care for or to basically rehab.
To help them transition back into the society. So
introduce them back into.
Right. And again, I think those are difficult to turn down depending on what's influencing, you know, what impact it has on the rest of the community and where it is. I think
until perhaps you have, you know, children and the offenders that are being rehabilitated were, you know, child abusers.
Right, and that's a different thing. I mean, it depends on who the offenders are and what the crime is and what the community's reasonable, you know, objection is. So it's really going to be fact specific. If you had a residential neighborhood and people wanted to have a group home for, you know, recovering sex offenders, things like that, that's one thing. You know, but if it's
alcohol,
if it's other things, yeah, I mean, shoplifting or, you know, whatever it is. I mean, I think that would be difficult just to have a blanket rule saying, you know, we're not going to allow that, you know, to take place. But again, it's got to be fact specific. Certainly in that context, if you had a person who could be a risk to, you know, the neighborhood or children there, you know, that's going to be an issue.
Do they have to tell us that? It's like they're sex offenders?
I think there's a registry for that one.
Yeah.
If they come and ask for a group home, do they have to tell us it is for that, or this is a group home?
If the opposition said that they would be concerned that there would be sex offenders there because they're not specific as to what type of rehabilitated people they're putting in,
right?
Then I guess we could actually put a limitation, if you will, on certain types of offenders.
Well, I would wonder, Barry, if I think we would need to look at what would be the protected class.
What's the protected class first? Is there some kind of a disparate impact
on
you know, racial group or things like that? That would be an issue. I don't think that, you know, people who have been in prison is a protected category by itself. It would have to be linked to something else. And certainly if you got past that, it would depend on, you know, I think you'd be entitled to ask questions about what kind of, you know, offenders are we placing here. You know, if it's one thing, if you've got violent offenders, you know, that could risk, you know, be a risk to the community, or shoplifters, or, you know, things like that, that would be a different thing. And I think you could certainly inquire about that. If they got passed, and remember, the burden's on them to prove that there's an impact. In that case, it would have to be, you know, this disparate impact theory.
They're not protected then, right?
Per se, they're not, but there could be.
But they could prove that they are.
If they could prove there's a disproportionate impact of that, could be. So there's two different kinds of discrimination: disparate treatment, which is just outright discrimination. You know, no Irish need apply.
Okay.
Disparate impact. This rule has a disproportionate impact on a certain group of people.
Right.
Could be race, could be gender, could be some other category protected by the so-called protected characteristics. So they would have to prove that. They would have to vote. That would be their burden of proof initially. Yeah. And then I think if that happened, you'd be entitled to get information as to what, you know, who it is and what are the kinds of standards that you're going to be applied. This is just another example of that. You know, the city of Butler, Pennsylvania, had a six-person limit on housing, and a group home for abused women, you know, challenged the ordinance. You know, they said on the face of it, that's a neutral rule. And what the court did, the appellate court did, said go back to the trial court, and the trial court should look into, is this really have a disproportionate impact on women? Because if it doesn't, it's really not going to be a protected kind of a category. So, and there are some pretty good arguments that you know, given those circumstances, that, you know, abused women who have custody of children, you know, and they're having this kind of a limitation, is having it, you know, having a disproportionate impact. But it's kind of a good case study because the ordinance itself is facially neutral, doesn't have any, you know, outright discrimination in it. But when you go to apply it to a certain category of people, in this case, abused women, it may well have that impact. So you have to take a look at that and, you know, and again, weigh those circumstances. And that's just a definition, again. Okay, and this is just an illustration that, you know, Stephanie put up about the idea of disproportionate impact. Obviously, if you had, you know, you pass a rule and, you know, a large number of people are being accommodated or, you know, being discriminated against, you know, that could be a disparate impact kind of an analysis. So. So this goes, I think we talked about this before, but, you know, this is the way they have to prove discrimination. They got to show that there was some impact by the rule, that to show that if there's not another way they could, you know, reach their goals, then you've got to prove that you know, that it's not a reasonable accommodation, or there's no way to meet the legitimate interests of the county in whatever the rule was. Let's skip through these because these are. Okay. I think I'm just about down to the end of things that I'm going to cover. I think Stephanie's going to cover the manufactured housing issues and the mobile home issues, I think, next time. So are there, like, questions that I haven't hit on or that you want to talk about from a fair housing standpoint or other things?
I think what you've given me here tonight is that you've got to ask a lot of questions. You want to be asking some questions, but be careful how you answer.
Careful how you ask it, because you don't want to make it look like you're trying to set somebody up for a denial. You're
right.
Trying to build a record, you know, for a denial. But I think the communication's the key. I mean, I think you're entitled to find out the information. Things like medical information, we know we've got to be careful with because we've got privacy concerns there. So, you know, we should have processes in place to try to, you know, protect that. But I think, again, I think it's a matter of having a dialogue. And, you know, if the applicant can prove the need, that's one thing. You know, if it's just a want, you know, that's a totally different thing. So
our standards for granting a variance are pretty, you know, they cover everything that you've been talking about pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, you've got it, again, the starting point is the person's got to show that they're covered by a protected category, and then it's got to be a need you know, not a want.
Not a
and
want.
Then you've got to, you know, look at whether it's reasonable or not. It may well not be reasonable, but if it's reasonable, you know, you're going to have the obligation to allow that, to accommodate the person with that. Jamie, anything else that we didn't? I know Stephanie's going to hit the manufactured housing. I know there's some issues. Is there an issue in the ordinance about having to develop standards for manufactured housing or being covered by a dwelling definition? I'm not sure about that.
Be better to ask that question too.
28? Yeah.
February 7th. Very far yet, but there's been issues where we've got some regulation within our code that says makes reference to a dwelling.
Right.
But the definition of dwelling is different from a manufactured home.
Right.
So that clause doesn't affect manufactured homes.
Right.
For example, I think it's a billboard for one. The billboard says it shall be 300 feet from a dwelling. It doesn't say a manufactured home.
Right.
So a manufactured home might be less than 300 feet, and we can't require it to be 300 feet away.
Right. So I think that's one thing.
But if you said domicile, then it would cover it.
Yeah, well, that's one thing. We've talked about
that. Yeah, I think that's one thing Stephanie was talking about to work with and try to amend the ordinances to take care of that kind of situation.
That issue come up a couple times, and it's technically not. There are some issues whereby you send notice to owners within dwellings of 200 feet away, but do you send notice to manufactured home?
Right.
No. We just use owners, so we don't differentiate or discriminate between one or the other. We just send them to vote.
Right. But I think it'd be a good idea to try to update the code and you know, make it clear.
I know when I used to take variances, you know, people would come in, they'd say to me, well, this, and a sharp lawyer would turn around and say, well, Mr. Rickard, that's not a dwelling, that's a mobile home. I'd say, see Mr. Lang.
We had that come up in the board.
Yeah,
it's a mobile home, manufactured home,
mm-hmm.
but it's not a dwelling. So
right.
technically, it doesn't have to meet that distance criteria.
Right. So that's the kind of thing I think, Stephanie was working on, I think, talking with you about maybe looking at proposing some kind of ordinance changes or things like that.
Or something else, too. It's a campground. The campsite has to be so many feet from a dwelling. Doesn't say the boundary, the campsite itself, but it doesn't reference manufactured home. It says dwelling.
Right.
There are several places that could need to be changed to accommodate and include the manufactured home as a dwelling.
Right.
Because basically it is a single-family residence.
Right.
So if we have a hardship case and you read the hardship case, it basically says to use a single-family residence for the purpose of a hardship or an emergency.
Right. Okay.
Now we advertise it that way. So it makes reference to the manufactured home and it makes reference to the hardship or the emergency. So it picks it up as a single-family.
You don't get many of those anymore.
Right.
We used to get a lot of mobile homes for hardship. We rarely see those anymore.
Yeah, we just did one and just advertised this past meeting. So there is another one coming up, but it's rare. It's not as many as there were.
Now there used to be. There used to be at least a dozen or more a year.
Yeah, it used to be pretty regular.
Now we see maybe one or two a year.
The process of you sending out the letter to them still in effect, right?
Yeah,
or you kind of ask them for a renewal.
You just get 12, 15, 20 a year.
As Bud just said, the process today is that the board approves it for 2 years for hardship.
Right.
Then the director can approve it annually with a letter from the doctor substantiating
that
it's still a hardship. You don't have to bring it back to the board every year.
He just gets
I'd
it.
I'd forgotten that, yep. Yeah. You're right.
We did one recently that was 12 years old, been renewed
every year.
Two, so 10 more years has been renewed.
I think council was, they were in favor of that because of the fact the $400, right?
Saved the $400.
Yes,
saved the people with a handicap.
Right.
They provide a medical hardship or met a letter from their doctor.
Right, that's right.
Or
saying the hardship
sometimes
exists.
Sometimes it's written on a prescription paper.
Right.
It's been a long time.
Something.
Yeah, because we haven't asked it put
we
on
still
the computer,
it.
Remember?
Still
oh, yeah.
valid.
That's what it was done, yeah.
And we have to, the inspector goes out to verify it's still there. In some cases, we avoided that because it's not there anymore.
Right.
You're right.
And that's fair, too.
Yeah.
It's called to make sure that resident that's living in that mobile is still
the
there, not a rental.
The same one.
Yeah.
We have to watch that, too.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't know if there's anything else. Jamie, you had or
no?
All right, and if there's anything, other questions? Otherwise, I think I'm done. It's not midnight. That's pretty good, isn't it?
You've done a very good job. Sure.
If Stephanie had been here, it would have been midnight.
I'm going there. I'm not.
No, thank you.
Thank you, Barry.
Thank you,
sir.
Okay, gentlemen, if there's nothing else further from the board,
part of the state.
Motion to adjourn.
I second that motion.
Motion by Mr. Mills, a second by Mr. Rickards, that we adjourn the meeting. All those in favor of the motion, give the voting sign. Aye. All opposed? Motion carried. Meeting adjourned, subject to call.
That's just.